With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
All call signs, this is Whiskey Uniform. What does it mean to be a modern warrior? First, warrior isn't a dirty word. A warrior is mindful and seeks excellence and has learned to control their aggression. It's about understanding leadership, developing individual resilience, and seeking consistent human optimization. Remember, lifting heavy isn't dangerous. Being weak is fortune favors the brave, and you're never given more than you can handle. This, then, is the Warrior You podcast, where you're the most important mission. All call signs, ready. Let's roll! Alrighty. Welcome to the Warrior You podcast. I'm your host, Bram Connolly, and I'm joined today by Trent Bernard, the Minister for Interesting Facts and Figures. At time of recording, it's a Saturday today that I'm recording. It's 5:38 in the morning, and we're going to be talking about Jimmy Carter, possibly the most boring person in the world to be talking about at 5:38 on a Saturday morning. Anyway, this is the leadership analysis series of the Warrior You podcast, where we are forensically analysing leadership styles throughout history, attributing them with a score for different facets of their leadership, in the hope that we can find some knowledge, skills, and attributes that modern leaders may or may not want to emulate. You might not want to be Hitler, probably want to be more like a Monash. Anyway,
like a Shah.
Yeah, that's it. Here we are. Jimmy Carter, born October 1st, 1924, in the rural town of Plains, Georgia, with a population of less than 600 people. And his parents were relatively wealthy, but not really at all, absolutely stone poor compared to the rest of the society. But as far as Plains, Georgia went, they were... they had a little bit of coinage, but not much. Plains High School, 1937 to 1941. And he grew up during the Great Depression. Devout Christian Baptist. He was, characterized as a tolerant, compassionate, hardworking sort of young American guy. And much of those values would shape his view of society.
His history around the church wasn't just about going to church either. On a Sunday, it was absolutely his whole life, and all of his values were around his Baptist upbringing. Obviously, his parents as well, and that actually, as you said, quite rightly said, that characterized his entire presidency, and indeed his the rest of his life post his presidency.
I have no idea why we chose Jimmy Carter of all the presidents of the United States, but anyway, I'm sure we'll find something as we go through this. So. He's an engineer. It's like someone has cursed me because I'm surrounded by engineers. I teach engineers. My army boss is an engineer. God bless him. And most of the people listening to this are probably engineers. There is a peculiar mindset when it comes to engineers, especially at the top of their game. They are quite awkward with people, I think, in a lot of cases. I've just lost 50,000 listeners. But yeah, he studied engineering at Georgia Southwestern College in Americus, and earned admission to the Annapolis Naval Academy in 1943. He graduated in 1946. And here's a fun fact, which you pointed out to me because you are the Minister for Interesting Facts. He served aboard nuclear submarines and battleships until he then inherited his family's peanut farm in 1953.
His time at the Naval Academy, he actually learned not to speak about politics. He was really one of the odd men out. And in fact, he was, whilst he was there, he was reprimanded for planning to attend a rally for Henry Wallace. He was an integration liberal who sought Democratic nomination for president in 1948. So he was going to be involved in this rally whilst he was there.
So was it divisive back then, like Republicans and Democrats as well, like red and blue and yeah?
Yeah, indeed. And it became more so, which is why he became... which is why he took on this, you know, peace aspect to the presidency, and he wanted to be peaceful.
Yeah, right.
Because it was divisive. You know, we're post World War II here. You know, it was quite difficult. His career in the Navy as well was actually quite successful. So he was doing really, really well, despite being that political, I guess, odd man out. But he was he was hand chosen by one of the admirals who chose him to participate in the development of the nuclear submarine program. So it was one of the operators as such. And he was doing quite well. Spent a lot of time in China when the communists took over China and the Chinese fled to Taiwan.
Yeah, right.
So he's got quite a connection, and he maintains that connection, normalized relationships with the PRC later on. So he's got quite a connection to that.
So his dad dies of cancer. He goes back to the peanut farm, the family home. So he must have served in the Navy during the war. Is that right?
He would have been going through Annapolis during the war.
Ah, right. Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
Mm.
Yeah, and so then the Cold War really is the thing that is the predetermining, shaping...
Correct. The aggression. The Soviet aggression.
The thing hanging around his life at that time. So he goes back to the family farm, and then he runs for... state senate for Georgia in 1962, which he was successful in.
Yeah, that was his second attempt as well. So he originally ran against Lester Maddox. Lester Maddox was the antithesis of Carter, and essentially, you know, Maddox had become a folk hero by refusing to serve three black patrons at his restaurant, and he used an axe handle as a symbol of his willingness to use violence to preserve segregation. And, you know, he actually lost the governorship to that guy.
Right. And then he wins it and is the governor.
He wins it later. Yep.
Yeah, he's the governor of Georgia from 1971 to 1975. So to put it into perspective, he's, you know, young Christian Baptist, Naval Academy, dirt poor, peanut farm, dad dies of cancer. He's a smart guy. He's around other smart guys in the Navy. Then runs his farm, goes into like a Senate, which is sort of like the state Senate, which is sort of like our. It's not local council. It's almost like state parliament, I guess.
Yeah.
Governor goes through, wins, ends up winning, and becoming the governor, which is like the premier. I assume, not knowing that much about American politics. 71 to 75, and then delivers this program of progressive social and desegregation, focusing on civil rights, economics, politics across Georgia, and was highly successful.
Yeah, so his platform was essentially the New Democrat.
Right.
He was the New Democrat, and it comes on the back of the segregation between, you know, that red and blue, the old liberals.
This is not unlike Biden, if you think about it.
Indeed. There's more similarities in here than you might think as well.
So he goes on then, just on that platform, I'll contest the 1976 presidential election. And Gerald Ford was running again, and he wins. He beats him.
He just wins. And that says something about the state of the country at the time, because Ford was absolutely uninspiring.
Yeah.
He had just pardoned Nixon for his part in the Watergate scandal.
I'm not a crook.
He had just pardoned Nixon for all of that.
Yeah.
And the country had no faith in Washington at all. He spent a lot of time talking to the people. He would travel all over the country, and all the people said was, we just don't believe you. You're the only there to serve yourself, and you always lie to us. And so that was what he was hearing nonstop. And he actually made a statement: if I ever lie, or ever make a misleading statement, don't vote for me.
Yeah, pretty simple.
He got that strong sense of morals about lying, not just from his Baptist background, but during his time at Annapolis, because as you well know, integrity as an officer, you know, how do you inspire the loyalty of your troops as such, if they can't trust what's coming out of your mouth?
It's the foundation. Move on to the scoring, initial inspiration, motivation score, and we can amend these as we go, but I'm going to give them 3 out of 10.
Harsh.
And I'm an easy marker. but anyway, we'll go into some of the reasons why. So he used his family background, deeply religious, relatively poor, self-made, hardworking farmer, came from nothing through to being the president of the United States. You know, his sympathy for civil rights, pro-segregation of the South, desired for equality, to perceive a reformist, compassionate, sympathetic president. So it was very, it wasn't strong, it was all based around peace-structured politics.
Think of the time, though. Think of how he's grown up, you know, preparing for World War II, going through the Cold War, Soviet aggression, you know, and one of the key tasks for the US president back in the day was as a mediator.
Mm.
And he really did seek to revive that grand old tradition of the US president mediating conflicts around the world. That's how they used to see one of the main roles of the presidency. So he was trying to bring that back as well. In the end, had a lot of people lining up against him because he wouldn't be controlled by Washington and the machinery that was Washington. And you might talk about this later, but he was that first outsider. You know, vote for me. I can be trusted. I'm not part of the Washington elite. And how many times have we heard that since?
Yeah.
You know, essentially that was part of the reason Trump came to power, you know, drained the swamp, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And it was Carter who first initiated that.
Yeah.
That concept. And it's happened a number of times since.
Yeah, I remember you saying there were political cartoons made of him as well, like depicting him as that farmer always hugging people. And the context of the whole Nixon Watergate scandal is really interesting. You know, it's an interesting platform, and it's that he had one of the Christian Democrat, you know, hardworking farmer. It's the same platform that successive presidents have claimed since Carter, even Trump, really. Let's drain the swamp.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know. Politically, he focused on moderation, placed himself in the center as a moderate compared to the progressive and conservative politicians. So he didn't inspire everyone, but he did inspire a big base. His moderate stance sort of made him look weak-willed and out of touch with a progressive America. You know,
I think eventually it did, but certainly in the early stages, he was. Yeah, he was actually straddling the left and right. And that's why I think he ultimately did become successful initially, because he was able to, you know, bring the two sides of politics together where that hadn't existed previously.
And if you think about the people we've talked about since, you know, before this, so Ataturk and, you know, the Shah of Iran, you know, and how fast they were moving to modernize their country. This is all happening around, you know, 10 years prior and at the same time.
Yeah,
you know, indeed. Carter wouldn't be drawn into sort of backroom politics of Washington, which is interesting in itself, because that is actually how politics in Washington's played. It is those conversations.
He didn't tend to collaborate greatly or work with the movers on the belt. And I don't know if you know, but he didn't even have a chief of staff. So he had nobody managing his time.
Mm.
So politically, when he was in office, he came across as a bit disorganized, because there was nobody controlling his input. And unfortunately, I think for him, he made a bit of a political error, because he made a promise, and then of course he doesn't lie, and he won't go back on his promises. But he made a promise early in his political career to read every bill that required his vote. So he would read it cover to cover, every bit of detail. And so eventually when he got to this level in the White House, in order to keep one of his, you know, promises, his moral principles, he goes to read every single bill. And it was taking up huge amounts of his time, when in fact what should have happened is he should have delegated that.
That's interesting. Which, you know, people should be looking at that and thinking, are you efficient or are you effective?
Correct.
Yeah.
You know, that's actually something to take away from that. He couldn't back away from that because his moral principles, he'd made this promise, he wouldn't lie, and he forced himself into an area where he had no ability to be flexible after that.
Yeah. Yep. And interestingly, the period that he was operating within, there was a deep difference between Republicans and Democrats, and he was trying to bring them all together. And again, we've seen this from leaders in the past that we've been analysing. If you're trying to be everything to everyone, you end up being nothing to anyone.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was where, that's probably why I gave him 3 out of 10, I think, is that he was just trying to be too much to too many, and he was just, his indecision continued to be his decision.
Yeah, I agree with you. I just wonder if anybody else could have done any better.
Mm.
Like, you know, we have to, I guess it's probably important to understand the situation at the time, you know, given Soviet aggression, given the energy crisis, given stagflation at the time, you know, inflation and unemployment was out of control. You know, we'd had an assassination in the 60s of a president.
Mm.
We had, you know, all this political instability. What he took over from, I'm not sure who else could have done it. And maybe he was the right president at the time. I'm not saying he was, but maybe he was. You know, just to at least have a one-term president that just tried to stabilize a few things.
Yeah, a post-Vietnam War president probably was up against it anyway.
Indeed, yep.
You know, some pros, he did have constant sources of inspiration. And, you know, and I know you and I have talked about the whole faith piece. And that obviously has a large base of Christian voters. His personality, his political moderation, his international outlook, I guess charting a course for America to provide peace and stability across the world. Yeah, so that's, it's all a little wishy-washy for me, to be fair. I like strong leaders.
Well, I mean, what leader would have done a better job?
Yeah.
I'm not saying he's done a great job.
Mm.
What leader of any era? You know, it's an interesting question.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, if you had someone like Donald Trump there, you know, at that period of time, a person like that, I don't think you, someone like that's navigating their way through Cold War and beyond. No.
Imagine that.
Yeah. So some of the cons, his methods of inspiration, you know, often caused his leadership just to be uninspiring. You know, he's just a flat, boring, vanilla peanut farmer.
So, you know, using the terminology that we like to use, if you listen, and he might be listening now, if you listen to some of his speeches, then you find it's hard to get the energy from his conversations.
Which is unusual for an American, for starters, and secondly, for an American president. I mean, we see people, we tend to see Americans as very energetic when they communicate. You know, Australians as a culture, we're not. But if you watch Americans when they communicate, you know, they do understand it.
Almost animated.
Yeah, and he wasn't like that.
But certainly, if you've watched his crisis of confidence speech, which, you know, was one of the first steps towards ending his presidency, you know, when he's essentially blaming the American people. You can't blame the American people about how much they're wasting. You've got to really tell them that everything's going to be good and provide hope and you can have more and this is the American way.
Yeah.
And that crisis of confidence speech, the malaise speech, was just deeply uninspiring, I have to say.
Dear Dave and Al, I had planned to speak to you again about a very important subject, energy. For the fifth time, I would have described the urgency of the problem and laid out a series of legislative recommendations to the Congress. But as I was preparing to speak, I began to ask myself the same question that I now know has been troubling many of you. Why have we not been able to get together as a nation to resolve our serious energy problem? It's clear that the true problems of our nation are much deeper, than gasoline lines or energy shortages, deeper even than inflation or recession. And I realize more than ever that as president, I need your help. So I decided to reach out and to listen to the voices of America. I invited to Camp David people from almost every segment of our society, business and labor, teachers and preachers, governors, mayors, and private citizens. And I left Camp David to listen to other Americans, men and women like you. It has been an extraordinary 10 days. And I want to share with you what I've heard. First of all, I got a lot of personal advice. Let me quote a few of the typical comments that I wrote down. This is from a Southern governor. Mr. President, you're not leading this nation. You're just managing the government. You don't see the people enough anymore. Some of your cabinet members don't seem loyal. There is not enough discipline among your disciples.
Look, you know, uninspiring. It just keeps coming out in the cons for his leadership. Uninspiring response to domestic and international challenges. Uninspiring leadership. Uninspiring looking at the cycle of lack of inspiration undermining his objectives.
But I think he did have a vision. He did have a vision of world peace and stabilization.
But a vision is only a vision if you can inspire people to jump on it.
Got it. And I guess the deficiencies in his presidency was his inability to transfer that energy to the people.
I wonder if he didn't have good people around him inside the establishment.
He didn't work with his cabinet.
Yeah.
So, you know, you compare that to Ataturk, who was doing a complete reformation.
Yeah.
He had good, strong, loyal people that would break their backs for it. You know, and one of the other major issues was that Carter was, you know, he had ideals, but he didn't have a prioritized strategy. You know, he was kind of there and he's kind of over here and you know, didn't have a chief of staff to keep him on task and those sorts of things. And I think that was part of his issue. And post-presidency, he was far more successful.
It's not going to shock you then to work out that we roll from that into purpose, providing purpose and direction. And I gave him 3 out of 10 for that as well because they're linked.
Yeah, indeed.
So Carter's main goals for America were to create a more economically and socially equal American and to continue a policy of détente marked by growing cooperation and peaceful relations with the Soviet Union and also repair political stability inside America. You think about the styles of politics. You know, these aren't capitalist ideals really pushing, you know, forward. These are sort of almost socialist, aren't they? So it's socialist ideals.
I'm not sure that's necessarily accurate. I think, you know, it goes back to that statement we made right at the start, which was that his Baptist upbringing, his belief in world peace and equality under God, all of those sorts of things. I think that is fundamentally where he came from. You know, his friends, you know, in that little 600-person town in Plains, his friends were all African-Americans. You know, that's how he grew up. He grew up dirt poor around African-American friends. You know, it was all and only about the community. And he feels like he was, it feels like he was a town administrator in the presidential office as a result of circumstance. He hadn't even finished his first governor term when he ran for presidency.
You know,
so he'd escalated pretty quickly.
You know, in 1977, just wrap your head around this number. In 1977, he implemented a $30 billion stimulus package to the United States, which created millions of jobs.
Yeah.
1977, $30 billion. So it created wealth and economic stability across the country, which was never seen before or since.
And he had to do that because of the first oil shock. So the first oil shock was as a result of the Middle East ceasing production of all oil to the US following their support for Israel.
Mm.
You know, so you've got to remember Israel had been recently at war, had gone through the Six-Day War. They had been at war with Egypt and Egypt's allies, and it was...
thumped them all.
Indeed. And America had come out in support of Israel, you know, weapons, you know, intelligence support, all of those sorts of things.
Mm.
So that was the first oil shock. So there had to be a stimulus because they were consuming more oil than they were making, consuming more energy than they were making. And that was the major problem.
Mm.
And then, of course, they have the second oil shock, which is Iran.
Mm.
And, you know, we've spoken about that. And that second oil shock where... the Shah basically convinced OPEC to start charging America at the rates that OPEC believed it was entitled to be, you know, reversed at.
And then and inflation grew to 11% in 1979. I mean, that had a ripple effect in Australia as well. I remember the interest rates back then people were talking about were in the 20% and the like. Yeah, misery index. What do you know about that?
So they created a new index called the misery index, and it was around unemployment. And there were a range of different factors, and it jumped from, I think, something like 9% to 20% in that time. You know, one in five people were miserable.
I wonder what would happen if they did it now.
there were queues. Like, I mean, I'm sure you've seen the footage, but there were queues for fuel out, you know, down highways, and it was. You got to remember that economically, the result that they were finding themselves in at this point in time, the oil shocks just built upon the reconstruction policies of post World War II. So, America had been encouraging offshore production in Japan, in Germany, and in those other powers in order to rebuild their nations. So it sent and subsidized manufacturing offshore. And then, of course, you combine that with oil price rises, and what you've got is no jobs, no manufacturing, high costs of fuel. So in turn, Americans turn to smaller vehicles, non-American-made vehicles, ultimately the Japanese cars. So the little Honda Civics, the first of the little Honda Civics, those sorts of things, they came to the fore, and people were driving those because it was cheaper, sending more jobs offshore. Mm. That's what Carter inherited.
A general malaise.
That was his crisis of confidence speech.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah. And so that speech was blaming Americans, was it really, for their own woes?
Oh, absolutely. That, you know, that they didn't have the confidence to, you know, the confidence to see their way through and hold a vision. In that speech, he admitted that his own policies had met with mixed success.
Yeah.
So he's admitting straight to the people, I haven't been that successful.
Yeah.
He said that in the speech. But, you know, this is also on you. You've got to start buying American. But he did have a number of policies that came out as
like wear sweaters when you're cold. He said that. So he wasn't able to repair the country after the energy crisis. They were seen as austere measures over ideologically driven not pragmatic. You know, his progressive energy policies of renewable energy in the day and energy rationing through Congress just didn't go anywhere. So it continued the energy crisis, made him look out of touch with people in the street.
Yeah, he famously made a speech during the height of the oil shortage telling Americans to wear sweaters to stay warm. And, you know, that cemented the perception of his of him being austere. Allegedly, the Reagans were appalled when moving into the White House, saying that Carter's removal of heaters, TVs, and lights made it feel like that the White House was more of a gulag than the White House.
Wow!
And he's, you know, he's trying to get
simple guy throwback to his grandfather's era, probably. You know, Carter.
Right, yeah. Stop wasting energy. Mm. You know, put a jumper on. You know, you don't need the heaters on. You don't need your tellies on.
Yeah.
Interesting, right?
You know, he sought to create greater acceptance of minorities, too, in America. Created the Department of Education in 1979.
That was his first political job. He actually had a real bent for education to improve the levels of, reduce poverty. And his first political role was post his service in the Navy, and he became got elected to the school board in Plains, and that's how he started. So he realized education was the key to lifting people out of poverty.
Yeah, and interestingly, environmentalist reforms. So he initiated the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act. Which protected Alaska national interests as well. He expanded healthcare, created a more public system. Who's that sound like?
Got him.
Yeah.
Got him started on solar.
Did he really?
Hmm.
He tried to implement progressive initiatives, you know, decriminalizing marijuana, affirmation action for LGBT community, and
didn't have control of the Congress, no. And he wouldn't work with Congress. So. Right. They were just not passing anything he wanted.
Yeah,
he just struggled with many of his initiatives. But in fact, he did essentially go against his own party to push through some of his bills.
A lot of those progressive points that he had, those progressive positions, actually decreased his popularity and increased Ronald Reagan's popularity because he was seen as more conservative.
Yep.
Internationally, Carter sought to foster world peace and end the aggressive international standoff with communism. He started, that was his, he put the first foot forward with that.
Yeah, and at one point, the US wasn't at war with anyone around the world, anywhere. And I'm not sure...
That's unusual.
I'm not sure that we're able to say that very often. But anyway, that's what he managed. But of course, it didn't stay like that.
No.
And the Soviets essentially took advantage of that.
Yeah, and he negotiated peace with Israel and Egypt in 1978.
Well, I'd argue that that was probably the most important thing of his presidency. So yeah. Right there, underlined.
I agree. He
got Egypt and Israel to make peace, and that's held.
Because if that didn't happen, we're talking Egypt as a proxy for the Soviet Union. Israel proxy for America, and the two of them going head to head, and the complete and utter destruction of Egypt
in the Middle East. Yeah. You know, imagine if that had continued on, how much worse the energy crisis would have become.
Mm. He was pretty weak, wasn't he, in his response to the Iranian hostage crisis? Though that's where anti-American Iranian revolutionaries took American diplomats hostage, and there was a failed rescue attempt, which would. You know, we can go into the whole military side of that at some stage, but that failed rescue attempt was because the US military were looking at efficiencies, not effectiveness, actually. And it was a new world era of complexity in warfare of which they probably didn't really understand. And then a pilot error and an equipment failure and so on and so forth led to that failed rescue attempt.
That attempt in itself was the nail in the coffin for Carter. Because once that happened, you know, he had no further support. You know, he didn't have support from the people. It was essentially over for him.
Yeah, I want to say their heart wasn't in it, but that wouldn't be. I mean, they were heroes, really. It's just that they didn't understand the complexities of that sort of force projection into another place. and the reliance, the over-reliance on technology that probably wasn't up to stand at the time. Yeah, it was the nail in his coffin, that's true. Yeah, his focus on international issues, you know, saw Americans perceive Carter as overly focused on the rest of the world, unable to uphold their interests.
He did have a number of successes around the world, and as we said, the Camp David Accords were probably the most important. But there was a range of other foreign policy acts that he was, you know, he was supportive of human rights. So he changed the focus from Soviet military and aggression to Soviet human rights violations to draw more world attention. The Carter Doctrine, which committed military intervention or military force in the Persian Gulf if its interests were threatened, that still stands today.
Yeah.
Hence the presence in the Persian Gulf. Those sorts of things. He did have some successes, but as he admitted by his own admission, it was patchy.
So, as far as providing purpose and direction, some of the pros. You know, he was able to get political, social, international goals over the line. The Department of Education, environmental reforms, international peace. You know, these were things that he was able to provide a vision for and then get people to buy in on. He had a coherent vision for America to be politically unified and a moderate country, so less extreme. Equitable society and economic situation, and he tried to project those progressive but moderate values internationally. So in that case, in all those sort of aspects, he was quite successful in that way, and it was a softer approach that America was taking, but they were getting taken advantage of, I think, internationally because of that.
Yeah,
which is the cons. He wasn't consistent. You know, he didn't apply a consistent approach to everyone or everything.
Yeah,
and as you quite rightly said, he even outwardly admitted that. Didn't really achieve any major political or social goals locally. A lot of his stuff was internationally acclaimed, but not so much for the American people. And he just wasn't able to build a strong fan base. He wasn't able. Yeah, so 3 out of 10 for me stands, mate. Leadership style, 3 out of 10. How would you even describe his leadership style? I'm not sure it is leadership.
A very interesting question.
Maybe I just don't like this style, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Which is also why it's important to
we base our whole business at Hindsight Leadership and resilience. We base the whole business around leadership being an energy transference. You know, we want to show leaders that to truly lead, you have to be exhausted. You have to be out there saying, "This is my vision. Who's with me? Bring people along. Show them the purpose. Give them the motivation. You know, enlighten people with the direction. Get them moving in one direction." But he just didn't do that.
What's the definition of done?
Yeah, he just all he did was. You know, he sat there making decisions.
An administrator with an ideal.
Yeah, and without providing, and as we said before, he didn't set up a team. There was no teams. It was almost the epitome of the strongman leader from the 1920s and 30s and 40s. Like, but he wasn't even that.
Yeah.
And I wonder if some of where he was effective in the collaboration with the Soviets, for instance, and the stuff with Israel and Egypt and the like, if he was just used by them because he was a bit of a soft touch.
I think he wanted to be. He saw himself as the peacemaker, as the gentle man of politics, because so much of it was not that around the world and in his own country.
Yeah.
I think he wanted it. But in that particular role, it's not what's needed.
No, and it's not. He didn't wield a big stick, even in Congress.
True.
So he didn't use his presidency or authority of his presidency, I should say, to smack people into line. But which is fine because, you know, I'm not a big believer in using authority anyhow. But the other aspect to leadership, if you're not using authority, is influence. And guess what he didn't do? He just didn't influence. And
not consistently.
No, and his morals, he's so moralistic. You know?
And I think that I think that's limited his ability to influence. So he was able to influence where those morals
aligned.
You know, those where those morals aligned.
But he couldn't break his own morals. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying don't have morals, but I'm also saying sometimes you know your morals aren't everyone else's morals, and you need to bend.
He wasn't adaptive.
Mm.
He wasn't an adaptive leader.
He did delegate occasionally. But he really didn't use presidential power. And he saw himself more as a guide rather than a commander-in-chief, I think. You know, he delegated executive powers to the cabinet through the Department of Energy and Education. So he did delegate a lot of his authority. But without clear left and right of arc of how people could then use that authority themselves. So in that way, it watered down his ability to get traction. And I think he was perceived as perhaps incompetent and weak because of this.
Yeah, and as I spoke to you earlier, you know, he would read, you know, all the bills through requiring his vote, and he didn't delegate that down. You know, leaders to have adequate influence must prioritise their work and choose the most impactful projects and issues and leave the others that are less impactful to be delegated.
Yeah, and you know, you've got Nixon's speech, you know, the silent American speech, let's you know, rise up. And then you've got, you know, FDR's fireside chats where he's like, you know, getting people on his on his journey and vision. And then you've got Carter asking people to help him in the areas that he's not strong in. It's just incredible because he was appealing for public help.
Yeah, but he had unshakable faith. Like it was like the disappointed dad speech to listen to him on telly, but he still had this unshakable faith in American and global humanity that we would all do the right thing eventually.
So
and maybe it's just not realistic.
So what are the pros for you? For me, the pros of his leadership style, perhaps, I don't know, international collaboration, perhaps. He had
morals and values. You can't deny him that. You know, he did not lie.
Are we saying that perhaps morals and values are great, but they do not make a leader? It's not the only thing.
It's absolutely.
Because if it was, he would have been the greatest president ever.
It's not the only thing. It's how you use those morals. How
other people buy in on those as well.
Yeah, correct.
I can't give him much, mate. The cons, where do I start? He tried to bounce from leadership style to leadership style, which is a failure in itself. It's not adaptive when you're bouncing from one to another when they don't work.
I don't think he understood his own leadership narrative.
I don't think he understood leadership.
So I think that whilst he understood who he was and what he believed in, he didn't understand how that translated into a leadership narrative.
Yeah. Which is interesting because he had such a good so much traction as a governor. But I wonder if he had a really great team around him as a governor who were like, can do, let's get amongst this, you know, and then he gets into the presidency and his administration is just doesn't have them. He just doesn't have anyone there who's supporting him.
Yeah, well, so far as we've gone through these leadership analyses, I just keep going back to Ataturk's team.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, he had such a strong vision, this ability to transfer energy and this team around him that was rock solid in its loyalty.
Team of teams.
And belief. Team of teams, indeed.
Enduring legacy, 2 out of 10.
So, okay, this is where I'm going to disagree.
Yeah, his life after... Yeah, the butterfly effect of the things that he did achieve were enduring. Yeah. So I'm going to let you score this one. I give him 2 out of 10 because I think he's weak. But anyway, he's noted for his devotion, his moral courage, didn't engage in backroom politics, didn't talk ill of people, stayed true to his guiding principles. Yes. In the early years of his presidency, he did achieve some economic goals. He did repair some of the American economy, as you quite rightly pointed out before, but who else could have done what he did in that operating climate, you know, Cold War, post-Vietnam, the you know, we're talking about the oil crisis. So, yeah, I give him a little bit of, you know, take the heat off him a bit. yeah, but, right, but what do you got?
I've spoken about Camp David Accords previously, the peace between Egypt and Israel, you know, greatest foreign policy coup of his his presidency, and one of the most important foreign policy results of you know, modern presidents. So I have to say it's right up there. The Carter Doctrine, which I've already mentioned, committing the US to use force to secure the Persian Gulf. You know, that is a politically and militarily unstable area that requires assets from around the world to ensure free trade. You know, he is widely regarded as the most successful ex-president.
They're right.
So no president has achieved more since being in office than Carter.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, he established the Jimmy Carter Library and Museum and the Carter Center in 1986, and he did that through sheer force of will by himself and his wife. He has supervised countless world elections around the world, both, you know, what we would call state-level elections and national elections. He received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2002 for his tireless efforts around peace and human rights, progressing peace and human rights. He continues to build houses for the underprivileged, for habitats for humanity. But you know, it's not that there are other achievements that he managed to pull off during his presidency: deregulating natural gas, creating the energy department, opening up Latin America to the US, giving control of the Panama Canal to the Panamanians.
Wow.
He established formal diplomatic relationships.
Jeez, he almost should have won a Nobel Peace Prize, shouldn't he?
Well, why did Sadat and the Israeli Prime Minister receive Nobel Peace Prize and he didn't?
Well, he did receive a Nobel Peace Prize
for later on in 2002. But at that time, in achieving peace between Egypt and Israel, they both got the Nobel Peace Prize. He didn't.
Ah,
so that's interesting, right?
Yeah. So what would you give him then, mate, for enduring legacy? I mean,
his enduring legacy on the world.
Because you know, just wait 1 second.
Sure.
Enduring legacy for the time that he was the president, 2 out of 10. Enduring legacy.
Got it.
For after his presidency.
It's a three or four during his presidency, and I think it's a six or seven on the world after that.
Wish you were writing, you know, my PARs, brother.
after that. Because this leadership style has really only focused around his presidency.
So he's a better statesman than a president.
Yeah, you would have him as an ambassador. You know, he was in the wrong job. He was a poor leader for that.
This is interesting because, you know,
since then he's been a much better leader.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
And this is what this analysis is about anyway. It is about leadership through their life, not necessarily when they were leading. You know, I mean, look at Monash. We gave Monash a score for his whole, you know, not just during Gallipoli. Well, I gave him 2 out of 10 for how it ended for him, but I guess now talking to you, we need to reflect on that as well. So to go back, 6 out of 10 then for enduring legacy. Happy with that? Lock it in, Eddie.
Sure.
All right, good. And how it ended for them, what do you think?
Well, you go first. I'm interested to hear your views.
11 out of 10. No. I gave him 2 out of 10. And the reason I did is, you know, he brought in that moderation of politics. he was really morally convicted, not pragmatic, and nor was he effectual. You know, it didn't affect change. Economically, high levels of inflation, huge interest rates, massive unemployment, stagnating wages.
He inherited that too.
Yeah, and he put however many billion-dollar, you know, inject into it, and it came back to those levels. Unable to repair the economy internationally. You know, he laid the ground for Reagan and Gorbachev, I guess. But the Iranian Revolution, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the weak response that he gave over those, I thought, you know, didn't help him. So, and that had a ripple effect on the US military for decades. In the 1980s, 1980 election, was perceived as weak, indecisive.
Well, you
Reagan
know, he was...
won by 10 million votes, mate. You know, I mean, that's with the, you know, that's, and back then, we're talking, that's incredible.
I have to say, I remember Reagan winning.
Wow. Yeah, I do not. Yeah, people were just dissatisfied with him, and I'm amazed that he was able to achieve what he could achieve after that presidency, mate. And maybe that shows that an ambassador, a statesperson who has high moral values, you know, and virtues, is going to be highly successful. But to take that into a presidency without the vision and without the energy, you're just another person.
Yeah, and he was. We probably haven't touched on it that much, but he didn't collaborate. Whilst he collaborated at times, he didn't collaborate for business as usual. And he was a micromanager. So from a leadership style, he was a micromanager. And you know, it's a job that requires building a team around you, delegating specific tasks to those teams, purpose, method, definition, and done. He didn't do that.
Worse than that, you know, Reagan and then George Bush went on to lead America for 12 years to show you the extent of Carter's unpopularity. People kept voting against Carter, you know, years later. Yeah, his personal conviction and humility was well received. Like, Americans liked it, but it didn't end well for him as a president. But it probably has in his personal life, so...
He found where he should have been all along, which was influencing the world through key projects. But
so we'll give him another 4 for that then. So 6 out of 10 because he did go on to inspire. So overall, that brings us to 21 out of 50, which is down there. I mean, it was 13 to put it into perspective.
It does take look. He is a deeply divisive president, and people either love him or they hated him.
So that shows you, that 21 out of 50, Trent, that shows you that being a good person only gets you so far.
Yes.
Being a good person's great, but you also need that energy. You need to be able to provide people with a vision. You need to build a fan base. Like, you've got to take them on a journey. And people have to do what you want them to do because they want to do it. And I don't think that was what he was able to achieve.
Indeed.
He wasn't very inspiring. And it keeps coming up the whole way through the research that we did on this. Uninspiring. It just keeps coming up in everywhere. And you've got to wonder if he had of, and maybe he was a really inspirational person one-on-one, but if he hasn't been trained to stand in front of a group, you know, I have a dream. You know, if he's not doing that, if a president isn't doing that, then it's not going to end well for you.
Yeah. He read out during the crisis of confidence speech. He literally reads letters. You know, in that very typical 70s, you know, reading letters to the camera and those sorts of things. And he does that. And he talks about you know, these leaders and community members from around the country sending him letters. And one of them he reads out, he says, "Mr. President, I just want you to lead us. I want you to inspire us."
Yeah.
And he reads that letter out to the people. And so he's reflecting on the dissatisfaction of letters. Like, that's how honest he is.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, I get that I haven't achieved everything I wanted to. I get that you don't think I'm leading and inspiring. You know, part of that's on me, but also it's on you.
Yeah.
You know, that, That I thought was quite confronting to listen to a world leader say to communicate in that way.
Yeah. Interesting. Yep. Okay. Well, let's wrap it up. Carter was the man of the hour for what the US probably needed at that time. However, he could have been so much more effective if he understood being able to motivate and mobilize a nation through inspiration. And that was his downfall. And that's probably the theme that's gone the whole way through this is he was a great man, he was a self-made, smart Christian country boy who didn't go on, he went on to become the president of the United States, but didn't go on to fully realize his full potential, I think, because of this one sort of character flaw almost. Character flaw or just a lack of skill. Yeah, inspire people, kids.
But ultimately, he found his niche in the world and has gone on to make the world a better place.
Yeah, well said. He did. Yep. Alrighty, who we got next week? Any ideas? Next week, Ronald Reagan.
Right.
So we've gone from one to the other. That's going to be quite interesting. And then we're going to get on to Oliver Cromwell.
Great.
And then Napoleon.
Excellent.
Righto. Thanks for listening, gang. If you'd like to find out about our parent company and the leadership and resilience training and workshops that they offer, please head to the Hindsight Leadership website, www.hindsightleadership.com. Hindsight Leadership, all one word. If you'd like to donate to the podcast, and remember, every dollar helps, you can do that through the podcast website at www.podcast.warrioru.com.au. There's a donation tab at the bottom of the main page, and all donations are really appreciated. They keep the show on the road. And if you're interested in the Warrior U military preparation course, whether that's just the physical training component or the whole cultural training package, this can also be found through the podcast website, www.podcast.warrioru.com.au.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.